This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, The Weight of Death is a compelling new docuseries about the heartbreak wrought by Philadelphia's gun violence. Executive producer Anton Moore will join us. Also, Sigma Studios was where the Philadelphia sound was born and where luminaries like Stevie Wonder, the OJs, and Patti LaBelle recorded. Founder Joe Tarsia will tell us about Sigma's incredible music history. But to begin, the state of Pennsylvania has just under $1.5 billion in coronavirus relief money it must spend by the end of the year. And now it seems as if the CARES Act funding will go to shore up the state budget, which has been battered by the pandemic. The budget deficit stands at about $1.8 billion. But as the pandemic increases in ferocity and businesses are increasingly impacted, some industries, including those representing restaurant owners and service providers, are imploring the state for a share of that funding. It doesn't look as if they'll get it. The Republican-led legislature has passed a spending plan which funnels care money to the budget, and Democratic Governor Wolf has indicated he is on board. Ed Mahan and Cynthia Fernandez of Spotlight PA have been following this story, and they are here with us with the latest. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
And welcome, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Some tough decision-making in Harrisburg. Let's first tackle the plan put together by Republican legislative leaders. $1.3 billion in coronavirus relief money is at play. Where would this money go in the budget?
Cynthia? Yeah, So a lot of it is going to go to state employees like the Department of Corrections, the Pennsylvania State Police, and the Department of Health. So basically, they're moving, since this money can't be used directly to close certain revenue gaps, they are rerouting that money to help pay these employees. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Ed, about how that money is being used?
Yeah, sure. And just the rationale that the federal government has provided to states in their updated guidance is that if these employees are spending a substantial amount of time responding to the coronavirus or trying to mitigate the coronavirus, then this money is eligible to be used for CARES Act money. And, you know, the coronavirus has changed so much about life that, you know, everybody is responding to it in some way. So I think that's part of the argument, and and these agencies in particular are doing more about the coronavirus than some others.
Okay. So again, you know, this federal money, federal CARES Act money specifically, was earmarked for coronavirus relief. And it seems that this is how state lawmakers are getting around this caveat to help shore up the budget. But I'm wondering if in your reporting, either Ed or Cynthia, you found evidence that this loophole could come back to frankly bite lawmakers, you know, that perhaps after the budget is in place, the federal government might say, no, this is not how the money should be spent. Ed, you see anything there?
Yeah. You know, so one thing we found, Cynthia and I, was earlier this year, the state lawmakers, they approved up to $300 million specifically to boost property tax relief. This is property tax relief that the state sends every year to people across the state to lower their property tax bills by a few hundred dollars. That money relied on gambling revenue, which, of course, tanked because of the coronavirus. So back in the spring, lawmakers thought they could use up to $300 million to sort of shore up that revenue. Mm-hmm. In mid-September, the federal government said, no, you can't do that. That's not acceptable. And so then they had to find another area of the budget to pull that money from. And since school districts did not receive their full payment, they're waiting to receive their full payment. Under this new budget, the school districts can expect to receive their full payments. So that is one example of the Fed saying that's not an acceptable use of this money. And, you know, I think one thing to look into, I mean, the federal government guidance about shoring up, you know, using this for employees is pretty broad, and it says substantial, and it sort of leaves a lot up to the states to determine on their own. So it's definitely something we'll be looking into and asking about, and definitely curious to see how this compares to other states. But the lawmakers do appear pretty confident that this is an acceptable use.
Okay. It's hard not to feel for industries which have been devastated by the pandemic. In Philly, for instance, a mandate prohibiting indoor dining at restaurants is once again in place. A number of industries have gone to Harrisburg to plead their case. Cynthia, who is involved here? Which industries are involved here? What are they saying?
Yeah, so like you said, a lot of industries are hurting. We have restaurants, hospitality, childcare services. We even have lobbyists that represent families with kids in education and different school choice options. And so there are a lot of industries that have been asking for federal relief funds for months, and they are disappointed that this money is being used, you know, for state employees. But they are still keeping hope that there's going to be more federal relief coming soon, maybe not before the end of the year, but maybe in January or February, there'll be more federal stimulus money to help some of these organizations, some of these industries. And another way that like Wolf is helping restaurants is by kind of removing a lot of the taxes and license fees that they have to pay. So there are different ways to help industries that don't require direct assistance, but lawmakers are hoping for more federal aid.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a thin hope because, you know, even now Congress remains, you know, deadlocked on further coronavirus relief money, you know, even as the pandemic worsens. Okay, so to Democratic Governor Tom Wolf, you know, this initiative with the budget has been led by Republican state lawmakers, but Democratic Governor Wolf is said to be on board. I don't know if there's any fresh news here this morning as to, you know, if and when he's going to sign this. But if he is indeed on board, how is he reconciling this plan with the pain experienced by the businesses? Are we talking about some of the workarounds you just mentioned as far as tax relief is concerned?
So Wolf is, you know, actively pushing for more federal money. But yeah, Ed, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, sure. If you look back in August, the governor unveiled a pretty ambitious use for this CARES Act money. He wanted more hazard pay for frontline workers. He wanted to expand child care access. He's also called for increased money specifically for food bars, restaurants to sort of bail them out. But yeah, I think that as part of the negotiations that just didn't go through. And the governor also had some other ideas for raising money, including, you know, legalizing recreational marijuana and taxing it. You know, that didn't go very far at all. And so I think, you know, what the governor has said is, or his office has said, is just that, you know, this is the best deal they could get, it seems. And that, you know, they're going to rely on federal money to help out some of these industries.
So in short, at this point, there is no bailout for these industries. We're still waiting for that as the state budget is being put together. Is that correct, Cynthia?
Yeah.
Or Ed?
Well, yeah, the state budget is pretty much said and done. You know, Wolf can either sign it or veto it or veto certain sections of it that he doesn't agree with. But it's pretty much set and negotiated, and lawmakers have said that Wolf agrees with this. Wolf agrees with every part of the language that it's in this. So, it looks like this is going to be the plan. And we're not, you know, restaurants and tourism industries across this nation are hurting, and they're really expecting more federal stimulus money. Whether or not that will be forthcoming, it remains to be seen. But if it's not through federal stimulus money, it looks like it might be through taxation, because these are one-time grants. And so that means they're not going to be here next year to help with the budget.
Okay. So to the Pennsylvania state budget, even after the $1.3 billion in coronavirus relief money is used to help fill the $1.8 billion budget gap, there's still $500 million to contend with. How are state lawmakers looking to manage this? Ed?
Yeah, they're going to rely on a variety of these special funds that have often been referred to as sort of a shadow budget. They're not part of the budget that lawmakers have to pass every year, but they are, you know, they do rely on revenue from a variety of sources. And so the state lawmakers, they plan to tap about $500 million of these special funds. Some of these are, you know, environmental funds. Some of these are workers' compensation security funds to make sure there's enough money in that program. There's also the state's rainy day fund, sort of a general savings account that it has for this type of emergency. But yeah, they're relying on a lot of these special funds and a lot of one-time money. And then even in addition to that, there's also, $2 billion in sort of federal money, federal enhanced payments for Medicaid that they're relying on as well. So there's just a lot of one-time money that they're relying on, and that really has the potential to hurt them the next budget season, because if this money goes away and revenues don't keep up, there's going to be tough choices.
How are state officials forecasting revenue streams over the next 7 months? I mean, the pandemic's going to be ongoing at least through the spring, according to what we're hearing from the CDC, even with the arrival of at least one vaccine. Cynthia?
So everyone, the consensus is that the revenue is stabilizing, even though it's not as great as it used to be. It's better than their estimates were in the summer. So that's a very positive movement. And we also see unemployment rates are falling. And so that's also a positive thing. It's going to be a tough budget season in the next summer, in the next fiscal year, because we don't really know if we are going to get more money.
And, and it's been obviously 2020 has been extraordinarily tough, as far as putting a budget together. As a matter of fact, lawmakers this year had to craft not one, but two. This is round two as far as putting a budget together. Ed, bring us back a bit.
Yeah, and so in the spring, revenues collapsed drastically. I think at one point revenues were looking like they were going to be $5 billion less over the course of 2 years than was originally expected at one point. And so they took the unusual move of passing a stopgap budget for 5 months. And that's sort of why we are where we are now. And in that stopgap budget, they fully funded education for 12 months because they said schools needed the guarantee of that money so that they could reopen. But that left, a large amount of the state budget unfunded for the rest of the year. And so that's what brings us to here, where they have to do all these maneuvers to try and make up to find the budget for the rest of the year.
Right. So this should take us through the rest of the fiscal year. Again, this spending plan, which I think is what we're $36.5 billion, with both spending plans this year combined, $36.5 billion. But the latest version has been passed the legislature, has yet to be signed by Governor Wolf. What is the deadline to get this done, Cynthia? And if it's not met, what happens?
November 30th. Deadline. Yeah, so that's when we expect everything to be signed. Wolf will probably, hopefully, sign something sooner than that. He has 10 days to sign the bill. This will be done in the next week or so. It has to be done. And there is a very important deadline for the CARES Act money. All of that money has to be used by December 30th, okay, by the end of the year. Or if not, something strange will happen to that money and it will be rerouted to the counties that did not get direct funding from the federal government.
All right, got to stop you there. Thank you so much for joining us. Cynthia Fernandez, Ed Mahan of Spotlight PA, great to have you with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Early Sunday morning, a 12-year-old boy was shot to death as he went to answer the door of his Frankfort home, yet another victim of gun violence in Philadelphia. The city has seen at least 435 homicides since January, making 2020 the deadliest year in the city since 2007. There are a number of theories as to why the homicide rate is skyrocketing. The stress of the pandemic and an increase in unemployment are just two, but the reasons quickly take a backseat to the agonizing reality lived by those directly impacted by homicide. The parent who loses a beloved daughter to a hail of bullets. The emergency room doctor who witnesses the scream of a mother who's received the worst news a parent could get. Or the young man who's selling drugs to buy milk for a young sibling. One small beef with a rival can mean he doesn't make it past his early 20s. A new 5-part docuseries seeks to humanize the numbers that seem to pile up with mind-numbing regularity by profiling families, activists, medical personnel, and public officials impacted by the killing. Anton Moore is executive producer of The Weight of Death, which premiered online on Friday. He's also a community activist, and we welcome him back to the Regional Roundup. Hello, Anton.
Good morning, good morning, good morning.
The first film in the series opens with activist Michael Tabon saying the weight of all this death is crushing us as a society. Anton, you've been a community activist for a long time. What prompted you to do this docuseries?
Well, what prompted me to do this docuseries is that I did a PSA about young kids losing fathers to gun violence. And it was like a minute long, each of them. And his stories were interesting because when they were completing it, the PSA, they were like behind the scenes telling me these stories. And I said, you know what? We need to get these stories out there. We want people to hear these stories. So hopefully that they take it to heart and understand what gun violence is doing to our communities on a daily basis.
The first person you profile is a young 23-year-old woman, Dominique Kimani Oglesby, who died in 2018 at the hands of a shooter during an incident in West Philadelphia. She had everything going for her, yeah. Anton. Give us a sense of what her life was about before she died.
Man, you know, talking to her mom and stuff, man, college student, getting ready for college. She was a singer, her beautiful voice. She had all the things going for her. And within a split second, her hopes, dreams, and aspirations went to the grave.
She was just a few weeks away from graduating from Penn State.
Yes, indeed. A few weeks away. And you know what? That's the stories we hear from around Philadelphia, you know, all the time is that, you know, you have these, you know, young kids with great potential but end up dying, you know, in the process.
You interviewed her mom, Danielle, and we've put a couple clips together in which Danielle Oglesby first talks about arriving to the scene of the shooting and then to the hospital.
I get to 52nd Street. I see cameras. I see police. I see white shirts. I see detectives. I see yellow tape. I'm yelling in the middle of 52nd Street. Don't tell me that my daughter is dead. Because my baby is graduating college in 3 weeks, and she gotta be there. Doctor come in and they tell us, your husband had been shot twice. He's in the back and he's okay. Your father-in-law has been shot. He's going into surgery. Dominique was shot twice. And not to go into detail of what they said, but they said there was nothing else that we could do. What some people don't understand is that I go through guilt. I go through a thing of, would she still be here if I called the cops instead of calling her dad?
And the backstory is that when Dominique thought that she had, you know, somehow been around a troublesome situation, she called her mom, and her mom did not call 911. She called her father, who went to the scene with a grandfather to try to help, and then the story ensues. It is very difficult to watch, Anton. Danielle Oglesby talking about her daughter. You know, the audio doesn't do it complete justice, yet she wanted to tell this story. Why?
She wanted to tell the story because she wants to stop the madness in our community. She wants her daughter to be remembered, and she wants, you know, people to hopefully look at this docuseries and say to themselves, look, you know, this is sad. You know, just for this past weekend, I've been getting phone calls from various people, just picking up people, you know, consensus on what they thought, and everyone was just heartbroken. And as I look at it, I just hope that people take this to heart and realize the destruction we are causing our community of gun violence. We look at this pandemic and say, you know, coronavirus is doing this, this, and that. Well, gun violence is a pandemic as well that we must pay attention to. And if you look at, and thank you to you guys for, you know, covering this, but if you look at the national news, you know, they don't give that much attention to gun violence in urban communities. That's why we have to create this content and put it out there so people can see that there are people hurting, dying in neighborhoods throughout America.
Yeah, a 12-year-old boy shot and killed just yesterday as he was going to answer the door of his home in Frankfort. You know, as an activist, you know, you've been working, again, in the community for a long time. How do these stories impact you?
Impact me a lot. You know, I have to be honest with you. I see dead people in my dreams sometimes. Young men I've helped who just didn't make it. You know, you have some success stories, and then you have some fatalities. And it does something to you, you know. I find myself going to the cemetery at least once a month, you know, just to reflect on life and everything that's going on. But I think what keeps me going is the success stories, you know, seeing the young men that we help or young women that we help go to college, seeing the young men that we help find jobs in the community, seeing the people, you know, help find housing and provide food for them. Those are success stories, and I think it balances itself out. But I tell you, this gun violence takes a toll on you.
Yeah. Well, in speaking of that, a successful story is Courtney Drayton, who he works at the airport, but he wasn't at the airport when he was shot 15 times, somehow survived. But you interviewed Jerome Tucker, who witnessed the shooting of Courtney Drayton and helped get him into a police car. Here, Tucker talks about his experience.
I laid on ground with him, and then once I laid down and he turned his neck around, I said, this is a bad situation. You don't understand. I had people die in my arms, man. It's hard to talk about that. I dream about shit like that every night. People don't know what you go through, and then it don't. It's not like when you shoot him, it hurt a whole lot of other people. You shoot him, somebody else might die inside.
You know, it obviously can shred, can traumatize an entire community, one person's shooting. You spoke with Shondell Ravel, executive director of the Office of Violence Prevention. He says when something like this happens, we need to wrap that community in services. What sort of services are needed, and are they readily available, Anton?
Well, you got to look at mental health. I think mental health specialists, having them come out. Employment and opportunities. You have people in our community that are falling by the wayside who are not educated, who look for ways to advance themselves but don't know how to advance themselves. In addition to that, you got substance abuse. You have people who are struggling with drugs. So it's not just a one-shot thing approach to how you deal with this. But you have to attack it from different angles. You know, even parenting, you have a situation where a mother may be raising multiple kids and the father is either dead or in jail. So you looking at that, it's tough for the mother to even, you know, contain her household because the young man is out there shooting. So you have to look at, you know, each case and see how you can actually execute to bring about the proper resources that are needed to address these needs.
That's a big ask. I mean, as we're talking about all these different aspects of the issue, are services available? Does it seem as if officials are listening and trying to make services available? And is the funding available to support these services?
Well, what I will say is, yes, you know, the city is doing what they can, you know, to address some of this. But we have to understand is that when you look at gun violence, it's an all hands on deck approach. You need the parents involved just as much as you need the city government involved. You know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, and the community leaders. So if everybody plays a part in accountability to addressing this issue, I think things will continue to get better. I think sometimes we get to the point where we start pointing fingers saying, you know, it's your fault, it's your fault. No, you know, all of us should be held accountable. But as I said, too, we need community accountability. We need city officials accountability. We need all hands on deck. And I think it could be more funded. There never could be enough funded. When you look at Philadelphia, that's ranked number 2 in big cities in deep poverty, you know there's a funding issue and it needs to be addressed.
It can be extraordinarily hard to get young people away from the street, in part because of the culture around snitching. As one young man says in your film, if someone's shot and dying, they have to leave it on the streets and not tell. District Attorney Larry Krasner says in the series that sometimes you do get to the truth through informants. But, Anton, it seems overall as if the fear of being labeled a snitch is almost insurmountable in getting witnesses to talk and murders solved. are activists hitting a wall on the ground and trying to alter this culture?
Yes. I mean, it's challenging. And one of those things, what I think the approach is, it's easy to get somebody to say something. You know what I mean? It's not that hard. But I think the biggest battle is, how can I help you first? You know what I mean? How can I help you get over this hump? Because you just can't go and say, we want to lock everybody up and take everybody down, because at the end of the day, you don't solve anything. You have to start to understand these young people, talk to them, and see how you can help them in the long term. The short term is great, but how can you help them in the long term to steer them away from the nonsense that plagues our community on a daily basis? I've seen young men, I know young men that I've worked with, that turned their lives around after being involved in a lot of this nonsense. So it is possible. It's just that we have to be willing to roll our sleeves up and put in the necessary work that is needed to deter gun violence in Philadelphia.
As the epidemic worsens, are you finding more people willing to roll their sleeves up, Anton?
We're getting there, because what needs to happen in Philadelphia is, we have to continue to train other people to do this work. It's difficult, because I don't know if you know this, but when you're working in gun violence for 365 days, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, assignment. And it is, I'll be honest with you, it is tough to get people involved, but the people that you have involved, you tend to hold them close, because when things happen or when preventable measures need to be put in place, you tend to call on those same people.
Some who are listening, might ask, why take to the streets? Let's listen to this one young man you recorded as he was in a car.
It's like I seen some kids hustle where they ain't got no food in the refrigerator. They mom on crack. It's just them and their little sister in the house. Ain't nobody gonna feed their little sister. He might be 16. He ain't even old enough to get a job. They mom spending the food stamps, selling his food stamps to the neighborhood drug dealers. That's the only way he know to feed his sister, go out and get some weed or whatever he got hustling. I seen it, and I couldn't really, tell him nothing different. What do you tell somebody like that?
So what do you tell somebody like that?
So that young man happens to be hip-hop artist Meek Mill.
Oh, goodness sakes. I didn't recognize him.
Yeah, that's hip-hop artist Meek Mill.
Okay.
And what you do is you talk to the young man, you talk to the young woman, and you understand what they're going through. But then you also find family members within that family. If their parents are on drugs and are struggling with some things, then you look within their family to find out who is capable enough to help these young people and raise them up. If not, then you need to get mentors within that neighborhood to try to help them and raise them up. Because like I said, it is tough and you are faced with adversity, but you have to know that you can't look at the short term. You got to look at the long term, and that's with resources and connecting with people that can help you.
You interview a wide variety of people involved in gun violence, people on the front line, like an emergency room doctor, Erica Harris, who says the sound of a mother screaming as she delivers the news that her child has died is something Harris cannot get out of her head. She doesn't wish anyone to have to hear it or experience it. And again, in this series, you wanted to tell all sides of this story. Why was this important?
That's important because, the trauma doctors, they deal with it firsthand. Imagine you working on a child and, they flatline and die. You got to come and deliver that news and say, we did what we were able to do, but, unfortunately, your son or daughter passed away. That's tough because, you're the first person that delivered the news that the child that they brought into this world no longer exists.
And you never get used to it, at least according to Harris.
You never get used to it. I mean, even sometimes I have to deal with walking into a home where I may not know a person, and they say, Anton, can you go over and talk to the family? They need resources to bury their child. Sometimes it throws me off, like, oh, my God. I have to get up and get the energy and the courage to go in at home, get that parent a hug and say, look, I'm here to help you, whatever I can do. And it's tough for me sometimes. You get those phone calls at night where a mother might be screaming, they killed my son, and you're like, oh, my God, and you have to gather yourself and basically, have the courage, to give them courage, to be able to get through these tough times.
How do you find that courage?
Sometimes it's deep down in your belly, and that's what you call passion. And that passion rises to the occasion every moment when you go through these tough things. It's passion that keeps you going to deal with this issue. But I can tell you right now, and it's not money, It's not excitement. It's not any of that. It's the passion you have to want to see people to live beyond today.
Another issue, Anton, is that young people aren't apparently hanging out on the corner as much as they used to, and more so they're hanging out on social media. And you talk to youth advocate Odess Blocker, who says social media is horrible. Social media and the beefs and the things that are going on. There are group chats where there are 100 kids and they're just talking about different things, escalating situations. You know, as a parent, it can be really tough to get involved with a world you can't readily see. So what are your thoughts on attacking this part of the problem?
Before I say that, Odess Blocker, we filmed that 5 months. 5 months after we filmed that, she lost her son to gun violence.
Oh, gosh.
So that was very, you know, heartbreaking. How do you look at that? As parents, you got to be hands-on. You know, you got to be almost become an investigator, a detective, and find out what world your child is living in before it's too late. You know, you can go in those phones because you're paying for those phones. You can check those rooms because you're the one paying the rent and the mortgage on those homes. So you have to, you know, we have to change our approach. If it was a hands-on approach that you was raising your child by, I mean, if it was, you didn't have a hands-on approach, now you have to have a hands-on approach because you need to know what your child is going through or involved in before it's too late.
So briefly, we've got about a half a minute left, Anton Moore. You know, it seems as if we're operating on two tracks, the emergency situation, which needs attention now, and then the second, which is the long-haul needs, like jobs and et cetera. Quickly, as we go out, we're going to be listening, you know, to Dominique Oglesby, who was a singer, singing mm-hmm. The Night Christ Was Born. But as we listen, just tell us what your thoughts about resolving both issues as we move forward.
Resolving both issues is a hands-on deck approach. We have to make sure the community is on the same page as city agencies to address these needs and to understand that the young people that die in our neighborhood will not go unnoticed, that we'll continue to raise concerns, but also we need to make sure that the government pays attention to what we're doing and apply the necessary resources.
Anton Moore, co-producer of the series The Weight of Death, as always, thanks so much for joining us here for the Regional Roundup.
Thank you.
Dominique Oglesby.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You'll never find, as long as
Lou Rawls' breakthrough classic, You'll Never Find, was produced in 1976 at a cherished Philadelphia landmark, Sigma Sound Studios. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Sigma Sound Studios has been closed for years now. Just last week, the building was placed on the city's Register of Historic Buildings, thus possibly avoiding the wrecking ball. The structure is empty, a small, nondescript beige brick building in the 200 block of North 12th Street. But in the latter part of the 20th century especially, it was home to one of the most influential recording studios in the country, producing 200 gold and platinum records. It was at Sigma Studios that the Sound of Philadelphia was born, also known as Philly Soul, a musical genre cultivated by Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, the founders of Philadelphia International Records. Musical luminaries such as Gladys Knight, Stevie Wonder, Patti LaBelle, and David Bowie recorded albums there. And advocates want the Sigma building to be preserved as a museum. Its fate, however, remains to be seen. The historic designation doesn't entirely rule out demolition, but the current owner says they are interested in working within preservation rules. For the remainder of the hour, we're going to talk about some of the incredible music which came out of Sigma Studios with Joe Tarsia, an audio engineer who was the founder and owner of Sigma Sound Studios. And Joe, it is so nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start, Joe, by talking about the Sound of Philadelphia. How would you describe it?
Well, it was classic soul music that was, I always termed it as soul music in a tuxedo because it used four orchestrations of strings and horns. And I actually counted with doubles and so forth. But some of the recordings is actually 50 performers.
Wow.
Well, so it was almost a symphony orchestra.
How did it evolve out of Sigma Sound Studios?
Well, it was really the brainchild of the creativity of Gamble Huff and Tom Bell, who created the sound and were the artists that envisioned that music.
And what was it about Sigma Studios that attracted names like David Bowie, Stevie Wonder, you know, up-and-coming talent like Lou Rawls and et cetera at the time?
Well, success breeds success, and everybody wants to record wherever the hit was recorded, everybody, record producers were at for that magic. And unfortunately, you know, Sigma was the site of hit records at the time, and it was a magnet for people came as far as Germany and England to record there because you followed it. That was the nature of the business.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to go to Detroit when Detroit was hot. That was the formula at the time.
Well, you talked about a referenced magic. Tell us about Kenny Gamble as a songwriter and how he worked with artists. His insight, his touch, how he used that to produce some really memorable songs.
Well, first of all, Kenny Gamble himself was an artist. If he could. For some reason, he was very shy, but when I would hear him in the vocal booth coaching an artist, and he would sing to them. And he was a natural singer himself. For some reason, he chose not to exploit it, but he was an excellent singer himself, and he imparted that to he would tell Teddy Pendergrass or whoever the artist was, he would phrase the music for them, and then they added their own thing. They each had a personality, but Kenny and Leon were the inspiration for what they did.
In the early days, before he hit it big, Kenny was trying to make ends meet as a lab technician at Jefferson Hospital. Is it true, Joe, that he used to arrive at the studios in his lab coat?
Lunchtime, yes. He used to run in with his white lab coat on. You know, Kenny was always hustling. He had a record store. He was just a natural entrepreneur that sort of never slept and was, you know, born to be a creative person.
I understand you also moonlighted as a lab technician in your salad days.
Yes. I was a lab technician at the Philco Research Department for 10 years, and the people remember Philco as being, you know, the television maker of the 40s and 50s and 60s.
So was producing there, I guess, almost a 24/7 existence? That's what it sounds like.
Well, it was a business that had no clock. And unfortunately, my wife, it was very hard for marriage. But you had to do what you had to do. I was a vocational school. I had no formal education. I went a little to Temple Grade School, but other than that, it was hard work.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And again, as you said earlier, you know, it attracted a number of huge names. Is it true that David Bowie came to work on Young Americans and John Lennon popped in as well?
To be honest, I don't remember John. No, I don't remember John.
Okay, I read that somewhere. That's why I wanted to confirm that. But David Bowie definitely launched Young Americans out of Sigma, right?
The Boss came. Jesus. You deal with somebody that says it's late 80s and these things go out of my mind, so you have to excuse me.
Oh, that's quite all right. So Bruce Springsteen was there too. Well, what was it? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying that, Bowie was there, he attracted. At nighttime, there would be a crowd of kids that Bowie would come late and leave when the sun was out. And these kids be sitting on the step waiting for them to come and leave.
I'm not surprised. First of all, tell us a little bit about David Bowie. What was it like working with him?
Well, interesting person. He didn't say much coming and going. He was sort of guarded. He had a big... bodyguard that was with him all the time, but he was pleasant. And when they left, he invited the kids that were out there in the rain, day and night, waiting for him to come and go. And he played the album that we recorded for them. We provided food. They sat in the studio and he played the album for them, and then these kids were so grateful. They were really Bowie fans. He was very gracious.
Oh, gosh. What an experience for them.
Yes.
And so another star that worked at Sigma Sound Studios, Teddy Pendergrass. I read that women loved to sit in the control room and watch him while he recorded, and he played off his audience. Is that true?
Yes. Teddy was an Adonis as far as women were concerned. I mean, his story is tragic because he was about, as I saw it, he was about to course into the popular spotlight and leave the predominantly black market and be an American star. Tragic accident,
in which he was paralyzed.
Very tragic story.
Another huge hit that came out of Sigma Studios was recorded by McFadden and Whitehead in 1979. We're going to take a listen to "Ain't No Stopping Us Now."
Held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our show together, we're polishing up our act. And if you've ever been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down.
Just love that song. Great theme song for tough times, huh, Joe?
Yes.
So listen, we've got some comments and some questions for you. Do you credit the technology at the time to some of the great sounds, such as high-end analog audio boards?
You know, I tried to fashion, when I
when I built Sigma, I looked to the West Coast and to the music industry because the sound industry was the recording industry was sort of still in its infancy, and it was the West Coast and the movie industry that had the money to produce the sound equipment and the high quality recording systems that I tried to employ at Sigma.
So analog, you think, do you prefer analog to digital?
Pardon me? I didn't get the question.
Do you prefer analog sound to digital?
No. Digital is the future. It is. Digital went through an evolution of, there were technical reasons why the original digitals sound that you could hear it, but it all had to do with technicalities, and digital is the future. Analog is too many limitations.
And here's another one, Joe. I've heard you were always fighting over the level of piano with Kenny Gamble. Is that true?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Whatever mix I would do, at the end, Kenny Gamble would push up the bass and push up the piano. Then after he left, I put it back where it was. Well, No. Listen, Kenny had good ears. We were a good team. I was very fortunate to have a client like him and be able to assist him in making the great record he made.
I'm not sure if this is the case. I'd heard that Kenny might still be living in South Philly. Do you ever hear from anyone who worked with you at Sigma?
Yeah, I talked to Kenny. Every so often we call on the phone and chat about, you know, unfortunately somebody passes away or whatever that was instrumental in producing the sound. We keep in contact, yes.
And we've got one more question for you. How did they fit all those string players into the studio, and where did they find the string players?
You know the funny thing was, in the early days, it was black and white, and at Sigma there was no color bar. The string players were little fat Jewish guys and little boy Italian guys and ladies and a couple of black guys as well. So there was no race at Sigma. There was no race at all. If you could play, you were in. If you couldn't play, you were out the door.
It was just all great music.
Yes.
So let's get really to... Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
It was really a melting pot. It's really a pleasure to be a part of.
So let's get to the historic designation. In all likelihood, this means the building won't, be demolished. What does that mean to you, and how would you like to see the Sigma Sound Studios building reinvented?
How would I like to see what?
The building reinvented. What would you like to see next for the building?
Well, it would be nice if there were a museum of types that honored the. Listen, it was a landmark before it became Sigma. The twist was bastard there, and it had a history long before Sigma. So it was a great studio.
All right. Well, we'll see.
Great space.
It produced amazing music. We'll see what happens next. It was just wonderful to have you with us, Joe Tarsia, founder of Sigma Sound Studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And David Bowie recorded his 9th album, Young Americans, at Sigma Studios. We're going out on the title song. You can find us on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today, Diana Martinez. Our producer, John Ahrens. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us. Be well.